told about the first time you rode on an airplane. And what were your thoughts when you rode on the airplane for the first time, when you were a boy?
Well, I'll tell you, it was one of the greatest thrills I ever got out in my life. Because when, I don't know, I guess I always had a liking for and an interest in aircraft. When I was a little kid, we used to live down the south, or west of town here. When they first started coming in here, it was the old GM Ford and Bird biplane, selling rides at stock show time. And I used to climb up on the highest post I could find to get up high enough so I could sit up there and watch those airplanes flying around over town. And I slipped and tore the seat out of my pants, and consequently I got paddled for being up there on the pole. As I grew up, every time I had a chance to go and see airplanes or look at them, why, I'd grab it. And my dad subscribed to the Popular Science magazine, and back in those days, there was an article on flying airplanes and on aircraft, in the pictures of how an airplane come in to land and the position of the controls and everything. And I read everything I could find on there. After Lindbergh flew the Atlantic, I read every book that he had and about Lindbergh and anything that pertained to flying. It really, I really ate it up and read it to all the way through. Well, this stock show during the Depression, there was two guys. One guy's name was Alexander, and the other was, well, doesn't matter. Anyway, they had an old Curtiss rocket, and they landed along the side of the highway just outside of the Union. And I asked my mother, in those days, if I went any place, I had to have permission from the folks. I couldn't just jump on my bicycle and go somewhere. I had to have permission. Well, I asked my mother if I could go out and see the airplane. She said, yeah. She didn't put any restrictions on me. Usually they put out a restriction, you'd be back by a certain time. When I got out there, they were just taxiing up to where they wanted to tie the plane down. And they had to come in to get gasoline from Standard Oil. In those days, aviation gas was brought in 5-gallon tin cans. And they wanted to make the arrangement for additional gas for while they were here over the stock show. And they told me and another kid by the name of Kenneth South, if we'd get shovels and fill in the irrigation ditches where they had plowed ditches to irrigate the alfalfa field, it was an alfalfa hay field, they'd give us a ride. So we got shovels. I went over to Roy Wheeler's ranch and borrowed a shovel, and Kenneth and I, we tamped those ditches till it was just as smooth as it could be. And they weren't back from town yet. Well, I waited and waited, and I took the shovel back over to and gave it to Roy Wheeler. And then I went back out there and I waited, and finally they showed up. And I don't remember who had the Standard Oil here, but he'd come out with a car with 4 5-gallon cans of aviation gasoline. And they poured in 2 of those cans, one in, on each side in the wing. The gas tanks was in the wing of the old Curtiss Robin. And they went and inspected the ditches, and the one that was, Alexander was going to stay on the ground, and the other guy, he was going to take us kids up. And they told us that we had done a very good job to get in the plane. So we got in the plane, and the pl- plane, the passengers sat in the back and the pilot sat up in front. And the old open cockpit planes, where the pilot sat behind and the passengers were up in front. So they put us in and made sure the seat belts were fastened. And they fired the old engine up and taxied out. And it was one of the greatest thrills I ever had. And when we took off, sitting in there watching the ground disappear below us as we climbed out, I just couldn't believe it. It was a dream more than anything. And they gave us a real good ride and advertising for Stock Show. And they flew all around over here, flew over to LeGrand, flew over to Embler, come back. I imagine we was up for maybe 25, 30 minutes. I know it didn't seem very long, but it was real thrill. Well, when we come in to land, of course, I was all eyes trying to watch to see whatever he did, but him sitting in front of us, well, I couldn't see how he handled the controls or anything, except I could see his feet move a little bit. And he landed it, and I thanked him. And I started for home because I figured I'd really catch it. Well, before I got home, I met my mother coming to meet me with a handful of switches. And she warmed my back from my ears to my tailbone and said, "I'll teach you to disobey me." And I tried to talk to her that I hadn't disobeyed her. And she said, "When your dad gets home, he'll give you another one." Well, my dad was a strict one on work. If work was satisfactory, that was fine with him. So she said, when Dad got home, she said, "I want you to give this kid another lick," and he disobeyed me. And of course, Dad didn't know anything about me being in an airplane ride. In the Depression, I didn't have a dime to my name. I couldn't pay for a ride. And so he said, "Well, what did he do?" And she said, "He went for an airplane ride." Dad said, "Well," he very rarely called my mother by her first name. He said, "Well, Beulah, I'm going to find out what the boy's side of it before I punish him." She said, "You just do as I said. He disobeyed me, and I want him to have another licking." Dad turned to me, and he said, "Son, how did you get that airplane ride?" So I went into detail and told him how they offered us a ride if we fell in the ditches. And before I got through, he said, "Did you do your work good?" And I said, "Well, they said it was all right and that they were well pleased and they told us to get in and they'd give us a ride." And I said, then he turned to my mother and told her he wasn't going to whip me because I'd worked and earned my ride and I was entitled to my pay. And it was kind of an unhappy place around there for a while.
I can appreciate it. Well, when the war came along and they interned the Japanese, you said that you were a conductor on the train when...
I wasn't a conductor on the Jap train. I was brakeman on it.
Brakeman.
Let's go back to when I first hired out on the road. I hired out on the section and... the foreman at Telecasas was a Japanese. His name was George Kobayashi. And he was one of the finest men to work under, I think I ever worked under. He gave us guys the benefit of the work. And we worked 12-hour shifts. If we worked over 12 hours, then we got time and a half. But... the railroads on the section at that time paid straight time for the first 12 hours. And I don't remember, I think it was something like about $2.50, $3 an hour, a day we made in the 12-hour shift. I think it was around 30, 40 cents an hour or something, I don't remember. Been too long ago. And so that we didn't have to come all the way into Tallahassee. He assigned me and another guy from Union to take care of the section at track at Crooks. That's a passing track this side of Tallahassee, between Tallahassee and Union. Well, there was Tallahassee, Crooks, Pyle, and then Union Junction. And we took care of the switches at Crooks. Well, the storm and the snow, it was the deepest snow I ever saw in this country. The snow at Tallahassee was clear up to the cross arms on the telegraph pole. Tallahassee was a helper station at that time. They had a cold chute, a water tank, and there were some of the engines that were coal burners, some of them oil. And they had a tank car that was hooked up to steam to keep the oil hot so they could put oil in the helper engine. And we had to keep those switches open into the tracks and the Y at Tallahassee. And several times, old George would even call some of us into the house, his house, where it was warm, to get warm and to eat our lunch or something like that, where we had a warm place to go before we went back out. And it was cold. It was around 10, 12, 20 below zero.
How did you get from one place to the other on a motor car?
We walked from, unless several times he put me on a train that was going to head into the passing track. And my first train ride was from Tallahassee to Crooks. And I had to clean the switches before this train could head into the passing track at Crooks. The snow had them drifted in until the brakeman couldn't throw the switch. And they had to stop and wait for me to clean the switches out. The brakeman swept the points, but the section men had to dig the snow out from in underneath and clear it back to the shovel. And we also carried a shovel, a pick, and a broom. And we had to pick the ice that where they throwed those switches, and nice to the snow, it would freeze and form ice. Then they couldn't throw the switch till we cleaned that ice out between the switch points. And George put me on the engine, and he didn't have anybody else. He said, "Vern, you'll have to work by yourself down there." And he said, "You stay there and work till you're relieved." And I think it was, if I remember right, it was long about midnight why he had another guy to show up. And in the meantime, I tried to keep those switches open. And we'd walk from one end of the passing track to the other and clean the switches back and forth.
The reason that you had passing tracks is where a train that didn't need to be as fast as another would go into the passing track, and the fast train would go on by.
On by, or opposing train, like a westbound train, meeting one going east. Why, the dispatcher would time them, and everything predicated on time at that time. And they put out train orders. Certainly, if it was a superior train, they'd wait at various passing tracks to a certain time on a schedule. Well, if the opposing train that was inferior could make this passing track, why, they could go in, but they were supposed to clear the opposing train, the superior train, by at least 10 minutes.
Yes, they thought that when the war started, that Mr. Kobayashi went back to Japan, but that wasn't true.
No, that wasn't true. He was interred in a concentration camp. He never did go to Japan, to my knowledge.
It was just people being hysterical about the times.
And I think he was a loyal American citizen. He was a citizen of this country at that time, the way I understood it, anyway. And I saw George later years, when I was working on passenger. I was working out of Portland. The Japanese come down and he grabbed me by the arm, and I about jumped out of my uniform, and I looked around, and he said, "Vern, how in the world are you?" And he said, "You don't recognize me," and I didn't. He said, "I'm George Kobayashi." And I said, "Well, where in the world are you going, George?" He said, "I'm going to ride with you tonight." And I said, "Hey, you're welcome to ride with me anytime you want to." And we had quite a visit. He was going to Ontario. Well, he went to Payette. After he got out of the concentration camp over there at Nissa or Vail or wherever it was over there, he acquired a little ranch out there between Payette and Weezer. And he raised onions and sugar beets. And he said, I tell you, he said, "I'm much better off now than I was carrying a pick and shovel on the railroad."
Another thing that happened at the beginning of the war was they put armed guards on all the railroad bridges so that in case of saboteurs. Is that correct?
Yes. And the armed guard, they were supposed to, just like a guard in the service, I guess, they were supposed to control the bridge. Well, not only the bridges, the tunnels also. The Weatherby Tunnel, they had a guard at each end of it. The Meacham Tunnel, they had a tunnel between Tallahassee and North Powder. They had guards there. And then they had a tunnel between Meacham and a passing track called Huron, down the Meacham Creek, west of Meacham.
And then the bridge right out of La Grande.
And right out of La Grande, and then there was the bridge at Hill Guard. They had a guard on it. And let's see, they had a guard on the bridge in the tunnel out of Meacham. And they had guards that, see, at the Weatherby, they crossed the bridge and went into the tunnel. And when they come out of the tunnel on the other side, they crossed another bridge, and the guard protected the bridge and each entrance to the tunnel on each end. There were two guards there. Most of them was colored guys. And they were tough. And in those days, if something was wrong with the track, they had rock fences along where there was chances of rock slides. And if the rocks come down and pull these fences, we'd pull the plug on the fence and then pull the block on the train so that, and we'd have to stop for the block signal.
The block is the signal.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And if a yellow block, we could go on by. If it had a yellow semaphore on it, we should go on by at reduced speed. But if it was a red one, we had to stop, and the brakeman on the head end would have to walk ahead of the train to see if there was an obstruction on the track or a broken rail or one of these rock fences pulled. One night leaving Meacham, we had a red block come up just as we started to leave there. So I had to flag the block down to Meacham toward down the canyon toward Huron. When I got down to this bridge, I had the flag and can and everything. In those days, we wore a brakeman badge on our hat, so that they knew we were railroad employees. And this guard wasn't going to let me walk across that bridge. And I told him, I said, "According to our rules and the regulations, I have to." And I had to produce evidence that I was a brakeman, in addition to my badge on my hat. And I even had to show my brakeman card that I carried, and my watch card, and anything that pertained to the job to certify that I... And he walked across through there with me. He didn't let me go by myself. He walked across the bridge and through the tunnel with me.
Well, the thing, if one of those lines had gone out, it had tied up the transportation clear across the United States. As traffic starts in Omaha, Nebraska, goes all the way to Portland.
Yeah, it would have tied traffic up in every direction. Because the dispatcher might put out a flat meet. What I mean a flat meet, like the train I was on, leaving here at Meacham, would meet an eastbound train at Huron. And the order would state extra so-and-so or number 257 will meet number 260 at Huron. 260 couldn't leave there until we showed up. Mm-hmm. Well, if something went wrong, we broke them too, or like this guard wouldn't let me go through the tunnel, it just delayed me flagging on as fast as I could walk to the next station or the next clear box signal. They might have to sit there 3 or 4 hours with a lot of stuff that should be moving, and it delayed the other trains, and it was imperative that we try to make the meets as close as possible.
The fact that LeGrand sits in the location that it does, and there's a hill either way coming out of LeGrand, has kept the railroad division point in LeGrand.
Well, that's right, because we worked both ways out of LeGrand. We worked in what they call chain gang freight service, first in and first out. And supposing I come in from the east today, and as they called, we go to what they call the bottom of the board. As they called the crews, we'd move up, and the next crews come in would go on the board behind us. And as the crews were called, we'd move up. Well, maybe we'd go west toward Reese and Hinkle the next trip. So we never knew which way we were going to go until we were called. And LeGrand was a definite terminal at that time. Well, the hours in service law hardly ever let us work. We couldn't have doubled on through LeGrand except in a case of emergency.
And that's how many hours that you can work?
At that time, it was 16 hours.
16 hours.
And almost every trip back in those days was 16 hours.
When you were working out in LeGrand, you knew Leo Miller.
When I first hired out in 1937, Leo was in charge of the board, and he was, he was head manifest clerk. But in those days, they weren't handling that many trains, and he was in charge of calling the crews, making sure the crews were properly called. Then they had a call boy that he would send out or give him instructions. But Leo was in charge of the way the crews were handled and how we were called either to go west or go east.
And when you were called, how much time did you have generally before
about
you had to be
hour.
On the train?
Usually we had about an hour.
Uh-huh. Now they had the regular board, and then they had the extra board.
Yeah.
And the extra board was when somebody laid off on the regular board, that they would fill in the spaces.
In those days, the crew consisted of a conductor and three brakemen. And engine crews was an engine and a fireman. And there was what they called a head brakeman and a swing brakeman. And the law and rules of the railroad and also the state law required a flagman to protect the rear end of the train. And the flagman had to have at least a 6 months experience in Oregon to work as a flagman on a train. And so on the extra board, it worked first in and first out. All the board moved like the chain gang, they called it. If you come in, you went to the bottom of the list and worked up as you got called.
Uh-huh. There's another question I wanted to ask you. I guess it was about the call boys, and
later on, Leo, his seniority, as business picked up, the railroad made him chief manifest clerk. And then there was another clerk there, his name was Dick Lindsay. Dick used to have a dance band, and he played around for Union Saturday nights for dances, and the old Zuber Hall on Thursday night, the old time dances, and sometimes Saturday night there. And Dick was assistant manifest clerk, but he worked under Leo. Leo was the head manifest clerk, and in fact, Leo was in charge, I think, of the way the clerks were assigned to different jobs and in the office at calling crews and the manifest of the trains. And if you needed supplies on, like, switch lists or, well, we call them wheelers, they were a list that had a listing of all the cars and the engine and the conductor and engineer's name for each train that was handled through the yard, and they'd get a, if a train was switched or made up, this wheeler was made up from LeGrand to Huntington, or maybe LeGrand and it'd have several lines on there, the train crew that handled it. LeGrand to Huntington, the conductor would fill it out, LeGrand to Huntington, sign the engineer's name and his name to it.
Who was in charge of the train?
Conductor was in charge of
the charge of the train.
The engineer was in charge of the engine, the conductor was in charge of the train, and his word was law as to how the train moved, and if there was any delay or anything, the conductor had to make an accurate report of any delays or anything that happened.
They had a demerit system, didn't they?
Yes.
And if you got so many...
You got 30 demerits, well, you could stand a, stood to be pulled out of service unless they pulled some of the demerits off.
And that was under these rules that you had to take rule exam every, how often?
2 years, every 2 years. If we was cut off over 6 months, we had to take it to go back to work. In those days, we had to take our watch into a certified watch repairer. And Jack Fair was a certified watch repair station in LeGrand. We had to sign a slip if we were in there. And Jack would, we carried a card that showed them to make a watch. My watch was a Hamilton 992, size 21 dual. I carried that watch for 40 years, and I still have it after being retired 26 years from the road, and it don't still run within 10 seconds.
Well, that's pretty good. It, on, this demerit system on the railroad, they had checkers that went out and would pull. What did you call them?
Tests.
From that test, what could they do? Or
there were several different tests. They had what they call a red lantern test. If they used a red lantern, they had a mile and a quarter in the red lantern, a half mile, I'll correct that, a half mile from the lantern, they would have to put two torpedoes, the official would have to put two torpedoes on the track.
And the torpedoes were what?
Well, they were a little clamp-on deal with a powder end, and when the engine hit them, they would explode. And then they would go back to a mile and a half from where the light was and put two more torpedoes, because the speed of the train was going downhill. A lot of times you couldn't get stopped in a mile and a half. And it depending on how the engineer had handled the air or what had taken place before we hit the original torpedoes, the furthest ones away. And sometimes the officials made a mistake. And I almost got fired one time. We come out of, in China is the top of the hill, east of Baker, where it breaks off to go toward Huntington and Idaho. And it breaks off this way to come into Baker and through Powder Valley, and then Kalakasset was the summit to come into Grand Round Valley. So we cut our helper out of Encina, and we started down the hill, and the engineer we had, his name was Bill Gooderham. He was one of the, he was a good engineer. He was a fine man to work with. I liked to work with Bill, and he really knew how to handle the train. Well, we come down around into the passing track. West end of the court, and it was right on the curve. Well, as we come around the curve, well, before this, it was where we had dropped off the heaviest part of the hill. Bill had released the air, and it would take in a running air test like that, or release the air, it would take maybe 2 to 3 miles for the air to charge up again, so that they would have enough to make another application of the brake. As we come around this curve here, this red lantern was sitting right in the middle of the track, or right at the edge of the track. When the official used the red lantern, he was supposed to leave a note on the lantern that this lantern would be replaced and you may proceed at restricted speed, which was 15 miles an hour for the first mile. So we come around there, here was this red light. And Bill saw it first, and he went to emergency. Well, as fast as we were rolling, it took a little ways for the train to stop. As soon as it slowed down, we went by the light, which automatically, if it had been a legal test, all of us would have been fired. As soon as the train slowed down enough so I could, I dropped off and I walked back to the light. There was no note on it, no message on it. And I saw a car sitting over on the highway, and it was at night. So I just wound up and I threw that lantern just as far as I could throw it over the top of the train. It made a beautiful red light going out across there. We went into Baker I cut the engine off, and Bill went to the water tank. Chain master's name was Lee Carroll. He said, "Ripper, you're fired. Get off the property. You can't even ride the train into La Grande. You'll have to get home any way you can." I said, "Well, thank you, Lee." And the general manager was with him, the general superintendent. His name was M.C. Williams. He stood there and listened to it. Carroll went into the telegraph office to call another brakeman to take my place. So I started over to the rector to get me something to eat. Mr. Williams called me and he said, "Just a minute, Draper, I want to talk to you." He said, "Why'd you throw that lantern over the train?" And I said, "Mr. Williams, if you don't know, I'm not going to tell you." He stood there and he looked at me for a minute. He said, "You're not out of service." He said, "Wait till I get a hold of Carroll." And he went in and called Carroll out of the office. He told him, he said, "You're not going to fire Draper." He said, "I got a notion to fire you." And boy, old Lee was he reared right up and he said, well, he destroyed company property and they got by the light without stopping. And Mr. Williams said, Darrell, you put Draper back to work right now. He said, turned to me and he said, you go over to the restaurant and get your breakfast or get your meal and I'll be over there in a little bit. And then Carol said, well, why are you putting him back to work? He said, that wasn't a fair test. He said, first thing, you didn't put out any torpedoes to warn that train that that red light was on the track. He said, and second, you never put a message on that lantern as to how it was to be handled. He said, I don't blame Draper for throwing that lantern over the train. I would have too.
And that's why all you railroaders had job insurance.
Yeah, you bet.
Because then you had somebody that fought back for you, so you got your job back.
That's right. And yep. I took job insurance out real quick after that. And then 40 years of work, I drew job insurance twice. One was for derailment, and the other was a break.
So it really isn't that serious. It's serious, but not that serious when you get fired because they look around for somebody to blame.
They always had to have the hand down. And the officials weren't all that fair. Maybe I shouldn't put that in, but I have felt that a lot of times some of the things that the officials pulled went beyond the book of rules and also their test standards.
Yeah. Now, you were saying that you were a conductor on the last passenger train into Portland and that you had donated your uniform to the Union Museum. Now, the importance of that would be that Amtrak then start operating through La Grande. And how long was it after that Amtrak discontinued?
I think it was something like 6-7 years or so after they pulled the passenger train off before Amtrak started through there. And then, of course, they didn't use the standard railroad uniform. When I went in on the last city of Portland, why, there would be no reason for me to keep the uniform. There'd never be any chance to work a passenger train after that. The Museum Union had a year that they were celebrating the railroad. I forgot now what the lady's name was, the curator that set it up. And I gave my uniform, the one I wore on the last trip into Portland. And that was on May 1st, 1971. And when we just piled anybody on that could get on the train that morning going in. And when we got to Hinkle, there was a bunch of people wanting to ride the train for the last time. And there was standing room only by the time we got into Portland. And it was, I don't remember, we were late, but not too late. And there was quite a reception down. At one time there was a picture in the Oregonian of me standing beside of the trap of the unloading the people off as the train stood there in the terminal at the Union Station in Portland.
The sad part about it is La Grande lost their passenger service through Amtrak, and they no longer take passengers through La Grande.
No, there's no passengers.
Either way.
Either way.
Yeah.
No, there's no way for people to ride the rails at all. The railroad thinks they have a big thing. They have a promotion deal every so often that they'll bring some of their equipment in and maybe go out to Union Junction and let people ride train out and then take them back into La Grande. that's only about 10, 12 miles of that one way. And to me, that wouldn't be much of a train ride.
True. It seems as the highway is blocked both ways from La Grande during the wintertime, it would be quite an advantage to be able to have rail traffic going either east or west.
At one time, that was the only way they could get over the mountain in the wintertime. I've seen it a lot of times when the highway was closed between La Grande and Pendleton, even La Grande and Baker, and the only means of transportation was the trains, and they kept rolling.
It's sad not to...
It is, yeah. You know the way the railroads killed the passenger trains, that was the saddest thing. When I first went to Portland on the passenger in 1960, everything was... the Ehrman family was in charge of Union Pacific at that time. E. Roland Ehrman was chairman of the board. And Averill Ehrman, he was an ambassador, he was also on the board. Passenger trains were number one. They were superior trains. And if you delayed a passenger train, why, they wanted to know why. And we would have, many times, I worked the city of Portland Road from Portland to Huntington. We'd have 4 to 6 coaches and 3 to 4 Pullman cars every trip. And we left Portland many, many times. There wasn't a vacant seat. And the trains were on time. People knew they'd get to where they wanted to go. The mail was handled on the trains, and they had what they called the RPO, or the Rail Post Office. You could mail a letter right on the train out of La Grande or Baker, anywhere, and it'd be delivered in Portland the next morning. When they went to kill the passenger trains, they pulled the RPO cars off. City of Portland connected with 2 trains in Portland. City of Portland was the Union Pacific Streamliner. And it was the most superior train on the track. The freight trains had to be in the clear 20 minutes at the last place for time was shown, or the last station on the employee's schedule where time was shown. And if you delayed it, well, you better have a real good reason, or you could be pulled out of service for it.
Sometimes during the war, harvest season for fruit and things like that, they would have fruit cars intermixed with the passenger cars, and we used to ice them at the station right there in La Grande.
Yeah, on the Portland Roads and on the,
right.
The old Idaho one. They never on the Streamliner.
Uh-huh.
Portland Roads, sometimes they'd put 3 or 4 cars of cherries or fruit on it. Well, in those days at Hinkle, that was the yard after when McGarry Dam went in, I think they moved the yard from Reed to Hinkle. And they'd come down from Yakima or Wenatchee or Walla Walla, Milton Freewater, wherever they loaded these cars out of, and put them on the head end of the train, ahead of the RPO car. And then they'd ice them, check the ice, and add so much salt, so many blocks of ice, whatever it took to fill the bunkers up. And I think they put, if I remember right, 100 pounds of salt on each side or something like that to help refrigerate the car to keep the fruit in good condition to when it reached the final destination.
Well, I iced the cars right there in front of the depot many times.
I imagine you did.
Yes.
Well, what I started to say is when they killed the passenger train, I was on one of the first trains that come into Portland after the Harrimans released it, and Chase Manhattan back.
took over.
And when the bank started operating the train, they immediately started to kill the passenger trains. They wanted the freight, they didn't want the passengers. They said it wasn't feasible, it took too many employees to operate the passenger train. You had your Pullman porters, you had your chair car porters, you had your dining crew, the dining car crew, you had a steward, and usually 4 to 6 waiters, 4 cooks in the kitchen. And then the train crew was a conductor and 2 brakemen. And the bank said they weren't making enough money all the time. We used to go into Portland with transfers to the Southern Pacific. At that time, the Southern Pacific run the Shasta Daylight, south out of Portland. 15 minutes after the city of Portland got in there. When Portland Yard was controlled by what they call an interlock system, and they had, they were telegraphers and operators that handled the switch. They had a tower on the east side of the steel bridge of the Willamette River. They also had one on the west side, and they handled the switches to put the trains in and out of the yard. If they didn't want the trains to go in, they'd hold the block red on us, and we had to stay there. They weren't blocks that we could flash. They were blocks that were positive, and you had to stop and stay until the one that put the block red give you authority or cleared it so you could. He held us. We were right on time with the city of Portland. We had 80-some passengers to transfer to the Shasta Daylight. He held us 37 minutes on the east side of the Willamette River, and we sat there and watched the Shasta pull out with all the empty seats, nobody in the diner or anything. And here these people that was on our train saw their train going south and they weren't on it. And I'm telling you, the train crew took an awful going over. There was a lot of unhappy people. Before it was all said and done, they would put the city of Portland in a passing track out between Troutdale and East Portland and hold you out there till they run a freight train out of the Albina Yard. Just put out a flat meet. I went to the phone several times and called to see. The train wasn't even made up yet when we were there. 20 minutes, we could have been in the station and on our way home.
Yeah. The question I was going to ask you, in Huntington, when porters and being black and what have you, the restaurants in Huntington had signs out on their marquees saying no blacks or only white help, and would they allow them to eat?
Help, but they used to feed the porters.
They did?
Yeah. They wouldn't hire any colored people to work in the restaurant. But at one time, see, the railroad had what they call the beanery, and it
yes.
was in the depot there at Huntington, and it was operated by the railroad company dining car and hotel department. And the porters and everybody ate in there at that time. And then they, of course, as the railroad down through, I guess they didn't get enough business. It was when I first went to work on the railroad, that old beanery there was one of the best places along the road to eat. And the food was good and well prepared. Most of them were dining car chefs that were the cooks in the restaurant.
Well, I just remember seeing those pictures of rails and derails.
Yeah. No, I can't ever remember them not feeding the porters, chair car porters, the Pullman porters. They went all the way through. And the chair car porters would get off at Huntington, and then they, of course, the ones that came over on Portland Rose East. We'd worked at Portland Rose back into Portland. And we worked, our job was we worked Portland Rose from Portland to Huntington and then the city of Portland back in. And the crew that come out of Portland on the eastbound city of Portland would work the Portland Rose back into Portland.
Well, when they changed the division point to Hinkle, that really is what did in the Grand Roundhouse, wasn't it?
No. When the diesels came, that is what really did in the Roundhouse, because when they run the steam engine, they had to go through the Roundhouse. They very rarely, a lot of times the steam engine would come in on a freight train. On the passenger train, the steam engines went through. They had a crew there that would, with grease guns, that would lubricate the side rods and the drivers and check them all over while they were unloading and loading the mail. And
they called those car toads?
Well, the car toads were the car inspectors.
Oh.
The other was the Roundhouse, the grease monkeys. And they used a heavy graphite-like grease on the side rods. And they had an air gun. They were put out, made by Allmite. They were a type of a Zerk grease gun. And there were usually two of them, one guy pulling the trigger and one guy feeding the sticks of this grease into the gun to force it into the side rod bearings and the sides where the cylinders went in and out of the piston housing.
There was a lot to think about operating a train.
Yes, there was. And there was, of course, I saw one engine that turned over Huntington Yard. I was one of the only guys that stood there and watched it turn over that didn't get called in on the investigation.
Was there anything else that you ever wanted to do other than...
Not till after I got a... after I'd worked a long time on the railroad they got a bunch of officials. When I hired out, the railroad men were railroad men. They knew how to switch cars. They knew how to handle trains. They knew how to tie handbrakes. And they got a bunch of officials here that come out of college, never made a student trip as a brakeman or moved up through the ranks. They didn't know the A end from a B end on a boxcar. And then they try to tell us how to do the work. People that had years and years of experience, a lot of times, when I got up to where I was old, I wasn't quite the older job as a conductor, but I was one of the older brakemen. I bid in a job on the Joseph branch. All it was a traveling switch engine. And after we worked out there a while, we knew what the shipper wanted and how they wanted the car spotted and set up. And we'd get officials out there and try to get it otherwise. Then they'd get us in touch with the foreman at the sawmill in Wallow, Bates Lumber there, or Boise Cascade at Joseph. And then there was a...
But that was a pretty good job, wasn't it?
At that time it was. It was one of the best. And you worked 6 days a week, had one day off.
You went up and come back in the same day.
Well, to start with. Then they changed it. You'd go up one day and back the next. And there got to be so much business out there that a lot of times I came in, several times that I remember, we come in with between 75 and 80 cars of lumber and at that time they used to ship what they called black marble out of Enterprise and went into Union Carbide to build flashlight batteries and stuff like that. Harris Pine and Pendleton was shipping between 18 and 20 cars of logs out of Joseph every day. A lot of times we'd leave Joseph with 25, 30 cars, come to Enterprise, pick up 5 cars of black marble, and then the grain growers were shipping wheat. There were 2 sawmills there, and we'd get anywhere from 2 to 4 cars out of each one of them. Get down to Wallow, well, we'd pick up Wheaters Lost Bean, get down to Wallow, and maybe we'd get a bunch of sheep. They'd load out in the lambing time, and lumber out of Bates always shipped anywhere from 10 to 12 cars every day. It didn't make any difference. We could figure we needed 12 cars usually to spot up the planer. And then they put in a chipper and start shipping chips out of there. And they, Bates also had a little sawmill at the Looking Glass. We'd take empties from Wallow to Looking Glass and switch out the lumber there and pick up the next morning to take back to Wallow.
Did you ever let any fishermen off there?
Oh, yeah.
And then pick them up coming back?
Pick them up. We'd load them on a flat car. We even loaded people on there that were going to drift the river. Stopped at Rondell and helped them unload, get their boats off, get in the water. And we'd whistle. We'd tell them we'd whistle coming down through the canyon. But we didn't travel very fast, 10 to 15 miles an hour. Not all the track would allow. And the fishermen we'd drop off from Rondell up toward Vincent and find them while they'd be looking for us. We'd pick them up and bring them back to Elgin.
A great time.
Oh, yeah. Well, I did that a lot of times. Yeah, and during hunting season, we'd load a bunch of hunters on the flat car with all their camp outfit, unload them in Rondell or Vincent or somewhere, wherever they wanted to get off down there. They'd stay out there all hunting season. We hauled a lot of elk and deer out of there.
Be about the 9,000 engine. It hurt.
The 9,000 engine was a 212-2, I think it was. The 210-2s were here on that 2 pony trucks, 10 drivers, and 2 trailing trucks. The 9,000 engine was had 3 cylinders. The 2 hot cylinders, as they call it, was out on the side. And the front driver had a cylinder, had a connecting rod and a cylinder in between that was inside, underneath the engine, in between the rails. And it was a scavenger cylinder. It used the, after the steam of the exhaust from the main drive cylinders outside would go to activate the third cylinder inside. It was bigger in diameter than the ones on the outside. And when it was cold, all you could see was the headlight and steam coming out of those things when they like come out of the roundhouse and hunting. But they were too rigid to run over the track here. We had too many curves that was over 8 degrees. And they were rigid enough that they knocked the track out of line. And here they used the 210-2s on passengers. They were, I believe they were 72-inch driver, if I remember right. And they used them mostly on passengers. They were a real slippery engine. What I mean is the wheels are thin on the ground trying to start a load or something. Like, it was hard for them to, once they got it rolling, why they could really keep it rolling. But these 9,000s coming into Huntington, why, you could hear them once they come across Snake River, coming all the way up from the river into the yard. And they made a funny, kind of a choo-choo, kind of like that, each time they would exhaust. In order to, for us to take the engines to the bottom end of the yard, or see, Huntington was a division that at one time, this wasn't Union Pacific, it was the Oregon Washington Railroad Navigation Company. And we worked under, on this end, under the old OWRRN rules and special instructions. And the short line, or the Oregon short line, was from Glens Ferry to Huntington. And how it got its name, I have no idea. But anyway, we always designated, they were the short line and we were the OWs. Well, one night I got called to come west, and in those days, they were all steam engines. I was the rear brakeman. So the rear brakeman would take the helper down to the east end of the yard, and then the switch crew would switch the helper into the train wherever the tonnage allowed, or right ahead of the caboose. I started that morning. We had orders that when we got in there to use the main line, because the section crew was working on what they call the swamp track, and it was kind of a soft place in the yard, and they were putting more ballast under. When we got called that night, nobody had any orders. There was supposed to have been a barrier set up with a red light on it. Nobody ever found the red light. Nobody ever found the barrier. I started towards the east end with the engine. And I got down in there, and I noticed that the tank kind of leaned off towards the north side of the track. The engineer stopped, and he had to go back. He said he wanted to go back to the roundhouse. The roundhouse hadn't filled the lubricators. Those engines had a lubricating system that, as the cylinders worked back and forth, it would trip a little trigger-like deal, and it would squirt oil out of these lubricators onto the slide rod where the piston went in and out of the where the connecting rod, side rod was connected to the piston. There was a slide there that held so that the shaft.